Audrey, what we're going to do is, see, we're going to be talking about Edward Wilkerson's record, and we're not going to play the selections. We'll play them later, but so I'll just be like introducing records that you won't have up on the turntable. So don't worry. I guess we're about ready to go. You know, and when we broadcast the interview, I'll have like an introduction about the record and who you were and all that stuff.
Okay.
So you about ready to roll? Great. Could you introduce Honky Tonk Bud? Talk about like what's the story based on? Where that came from?
Okay, Honky Tonk Bud is a. It was originally. I'll tell you how it happened. This is the real story. Nobody knows this, except I've said this about 20 times. This is the real story. Actor in Chicago, his name is John Tolles Bay, approached me about a poem that he had learned, and it was based on a jailhouse toast. And it's a jailhouse toast. It's not something you eat in prison. It's a poem that celebrates a particular person or. It's a legendary poem that celebrates, and most of these guys kind of lived on a marginal kind of life. And this one celebrated somebody named Honky Tonk Bud, who was a drug dealer, pimp, pusher. And it's something that's a necessary kind of function in prison. These guys recite these things to each other, and I think it's part entertainment and it's part to prove that you can narrate in a lot of dramatic presentation. So, he had learned this one, and he used to do it kind of by himself. And he used to do it on the street and make money. He had a couple of these he would do. So he came to me and said, "Yeah, Ed, I got this poem. It's bad. You got to hear it." So he said he did it. I said, "Yeah, I like that. I got a concert coming up with just a trio, me and drums and bass. Let me write a few things and improvise a few things behind you. We're going to, do it." And we did. Worked out real nice.
Well, for the benefit of our listeners who will be hearing this for the first time, can you explain, just give a kind of overview of what happens in the story?
Okay, well, I'll tell you. It's about this guy, Honky Tonk Bud. He's kind of a marginal character. He's appreciated by some people, and he's scorned by some, as we all are, I'm sure. And he is entrapped by the law into selling some drugs to an FBI agent, which he doesn't know is an agent at that time. Later, his court case comes up, and all the supporters come out to court to express their opinion about what's happening. And then finally, he gets, you have the trial, and he gets his, the outcome. And it's an interesting piece because we've tried to keep a certain kind of authenticity in it without being it's still maintaining some good taste, and it's kind of a thin line you walk there. So that's the general plot of the piece.
Well, let's listen to it from the Shadow Vignettes record, Birth of a Notion, on Sesame's Records. This is Honky Tonk Bud. It's with lyrics adopted by John Tolles Bay, who's also the narrator on the song, and with David Swifferoni Smith, and music by my guest, Edward Wilkerson. This is Honky Tonk Bud.
Stood. He stood watching the game of pool. Now he was leaning against the wall as the house racked the balls. Old Bud was looking real, real cool. choked up tight in a white on white with his hoes gathered all around. He had a peppermint striped tie running down to his fly, and he was sporting a gold dust crown. It was the 15th frame of a 9-ball game, and old Bud, he stood watching the play. With an idle shrug, he turned and dug a really strange cat coming his way. It was a funny built cat in a funny style hat that looked to be 9 years old, in a wrinkled up vine and needing to shine, and he was shivering as if he was cold. Now as he moved in close, his nose kept running and water dripped from his eyes. Hunky tongue pinned as the stud moved in and done measured him up for size. Now all the other studs except for Hunky Tongue Bud, they took him for an ordinary flunky, but through well trained eyes and many past highs, old Bud took the stud for a junkie. Hunky Tongue grinned as the stud moved in and asked if he knew Crow. For Crow wasn't around, he had been gunned down less than a week ago. Now the stud looked drugged like he was bugged when he heard that Crow was gone. But behind that, Bud knew where he was at. He was sick and wanted to get on. But since you look like you're sick and may need a fix, I can do a solid for you. I'm Hunky Tongue Bud, the hip cat stud from over on 8th Avenue. Now if you want a cop, then let's talk shop. I will even help you score. But you will need a bill, cause the deal's wholesale, and that's the only connection I know. Now the stud, he looks down in a half-way frown as though trying to make up his mind. Well, I got the bread, but I'm leery, says I'm looking for the best I can find. Now before I spend all my ends, this shit's got to be dynamite. Cause there's two other cats that got Luke's hat, and they won't let me out of their sight. Now if you cop a bag and the stuff's no bag, I will get you a cop some more. But we need a load to take on the road. We're traveling boosters, you know. Bud hesitated, he'd underestimated. He thought he would make a big sting. But the dude was no dummy, would go for the funnest. So Bud had to cop the real thing. But says I can get you a lease on a real nice piece, and you can save your ends. First you try, then you buy. I'll fix you up real nice, my friend. Now you wait in the store until I score. I won't be gone for long. Bud showed quick, for he was also sick, and they went to his crib to get on. Bud unwrapped two spikes he had strapped to a holster above his knee. Poured some smack from a 10-fold pack, and they both rolled up their sleeves. Cooked just a taste on a kitchen match blade. Bud told the stud to take it slow, because this stuff is potent enough to knock anybody's dick on the floor. Now the stud, he grew tired from trying so hard to make a righteous hit. When the stud hit red, the hip cat said, man, this is some dynamite shit. Now they both shot that thing, even smoked a little cane before Bud went into his dip. That's when the stud looked around, his Bud nodded down with slob dripping from his lip. Conversation was a drag, chins began to sag. That's when Bud says, ooh wee, I am high. That's when the stud made a pass, flashed out of bed to say, ooh, Bud, I'm the FBI. Now the courtroom was packed, for old Bud had been cracked. All the whores and hustlers were there. Those that knew him, the agent that screwed him, and all those who just came to stare. There was Sweet Draws Lucy, looking all juicy, half head and stumble Joe Blue. Wimpy the Grinner, the Good Trick Finner, Stick Pin and Tuck Titty Sue. There was JoJo the Rabbit, the hustler's girl's habit, who was out trying to get him some more. Brennan Slane and Player Kane come barging through the door. That well-known fella, Scotty the Teller, old dum-dum with two mob chicks, 90-proof Mary, Sweet Thing Jerry, Betty and Speakeasy Nick. There was Creeper McFear, the storekeeper Terry, with Pretty Bop and his June Bug act, Whiskey Top Ed, who's crazy in the head, plus with a Ronnie the Mac. Lean as could be was his lady Shirley, who had just come to think. She was real, real shy, looking all fly, playing a three-piece mink. Love Pump Fanny, Tugboat Annie, Booty the Gambling Queen, Veronica Rocker, the two-bit doctor, they all came down to say, Hunky Tongue Bud, the hip cat stud, please do not send him away. Give him a play, said that more man Toes Bay, he was only trying to survive. If he takes this fall, he'll feel real small, and that will truly hurt his pride. Then all eyes right to a hell of a sight as Treaty McKnight stepped in sporting a cashmere vine, while a professional killer named Murdering Sam Miller guards the man from behind.
Now the dope houses were closed, there weren't any whores, and crime was at a shocking decrease. While the precinct books stayed on their hooks, and for hours there hadn't been a bus. The phone didn't beep, the dispatcher fell asleep, and the Proud Cause was raising a fuss. Busted cool and unshaken as the cold oath was taken while the charges were read by the clerk. Then old Judge Stern, who's known to be firm, started the trial with a smirk. Now let us proceed, how do you plead to these indictments of selling junk? Well, not guilty, say Bud, the hip cat stood, the charges were trumped from the jump. Now the DA, Paula Gray, she presented the case, and the agent involved took the stand. Why, he told in detail how he'd gotten the sale, and that Bud was a big-time man.
He's got an ad machine mind, wears $900 fines, drives a caddy as long as a train. He might act like a squirrel, but he's pimping young girls and is the master of a confidence game.
Purvis Spence, the hip cat's defense, was known as the all-time great. In the palm of his hand, they buzz 10 grand and also the breads of his fate.
Well, I can't beat it, he said, as he counted Bud's bread. That's a fact you might as well face. Edgar J. Pagan, the narco agent, why he's built up an airtight case. Your record's too long and that game, it's too strong. I can't buy a break nowhere. The jury's picking's done, I can't get to no one, and the lab technicians won't buy. The DA is scared and won't take the bread, and Bud, you just don't buy the FBI. I've tried other things, my political strings, but the word is hands off, no can do. I'm sorry, Bud, but that's the rub. They're out to make an example out of you.
Now, these were the facts as the DA attacked the character of Hunky Tonk Bud. The hustler slurred as they heard his name smirched, trampled and dragged through the mud. But all the while, through the storm of the trial, Hunky Tonk said with a smile. Now the jury went out for a 12-hour bout, and in time a foreman named Hodge, so gravely concerned, announced on return the defendant is guilty as charged. The hustlers yelled frame, called the jurors some names, a few even voiced some threats. Then old Judge Stern, who's known to be firm, banged for order with his mallet. The hustlers quailed as a sudden hush fell, so silent in wonder, it sounded like thunder when the judge cleared his throat and asked Bud by vote, does the defendant have anything to say? Well, I do say, Bud, the hip cat stood before you send me away. Now, I ain't crying because the agent is lying, and if you all with this notion that I'm a big wheel in the narcotic field, and I do hope he gets that promotion. Well, I knew from the jump you were holding the trumps when you wouldn't let my lawyer object. A fact is a fact, and a stack is a stack, and I couldn't make you shuffle the deck. Now I'll get a full load, cause I stayed to the cold. You will make an example of me. While some drunken villain runs over your children, pays a small fine and goes free. But all the same, it's all in the game. I knew when I sat down to play. I took on the odds, and you dealt the low cards, but this is the price I must pay. But here's a note for your reporters to quote. And Bud took his time with a big grin and said, but those of you who know me can tell them for sure, this is the same kind of grin when I win.
That was Honky Tonk Bud with music by my guest Edward Wilkerson from the Shadow Vignettes record Birth of a Notion, available on Sesame's Records. That ends in a kind of interesting way in terms of the plot. Honky Tonk Bud is busted by the FBI while he's selling drugs. He goes to trial. He's sentenced. He's thrown in jail. Mm. And in the video, you see this also as the jail door is slamming shut on him. He says, "This is the same kind of grin when I win," mm-hmm. and he remains totally cool throughout the whole thing, even when he's sentenced and he's thrown in jail. And it's a kind of ambiguous message about what's happening to the drug dealer who was busted and then thrown into jail, but still remains on top of it.
Yeah, and I wanted it to be able to people to be able to appreciate it on a lot of different levels. I didn't want it to be something that was going to be real heavy handed, and I wanted kids to be able to see it and relate to it and still get something out of it. And I feel it's a strong anti-drug piece. I mean, some people might not, but I think it is. And if you look at it, you can't preach to kids, you know. We tried to put this together so it would lead kids into it and kind of, they might emulate this guy, and then at the end they see the results of what he's done. I emulate Bud. There are qualities about him I like. He's a very principled person. He sticks to his principles, but it just shows you when you're unwilling to bend. I mean, it's nice to have principles, but when you're unwilling to bend or change or see the error in your ways, you have to pay the consequences, and that's something that that's the kind of lessons I'd like to have kids learn. Instead of saying, "Don't use drugs," I'd like them to understand whatever you do, you got to pay the consequences for it. And they can figure that out. Well, if I use drugs, I don't have to pay the consequences or whatever those consequences might be. And those are the kind of things I'd like kids to learn than just to come out with a message. This is a guy who uses drugs. He ends up in jail. You know, that won't move anybody and it won't have any impact, I don't think. So I like having the message that can be appreciated on a lot of different levels. And it is ambiguous in a way. And I would like people to think about it and have to listen to it a couple of times because the lyrics are very intricate. There's a lot of technical language in there that I didn't know when I first heard it because I'm not a drug person myself. And I had to have some technical people who had expertise in that line of work to come and tell me a lot of these things. But I think it's a side of life that needs to be seen and heard by people. And it exists. You know, I mean, you can turn your head away, but I know people who live like that because some of the people in the movie are people who actually are those people. And they do live that street existence. And it's sad to say, but the fellow who helped write the lyrics, Swift-Roni the Mac, he's dead now. He was killed about 2 months ago, and it was in a deal that went down bad. And he lived that life. He's in the film, and he helped write the lyrics. And we had some real people, and that's the authenticity and honesty that I wanted in the film. It's too bad. His situation, but it just shows you. I mean, it's a very serious kind of existence, and it needs to be seen. I don't think people should turn their head from it. And I hope people understand that and take this in the right kind of light. It's not something we're not trying to exploit a type of person or an idea. I just wanted to expose some things and have people face up to things and kind of see things. So that was why I did this.
Are you interested in injecting storytelling or dramatic ideas into your music? What does that bring to music to you?
Well, I think the music is inherently dramatic. And I'd like to try to milk all the drama out of these pieces and out of the music and maybe portray them in different ways, whether it's through poetry or it's through dance or it's through certain situations that might develop on the stage.
Let me ask you about drama on music and drama on a really completely different level. Mm-hmm. Are you interested in TV music or film music at all?
Yeah, I'd like to do some more films. Not necessarily TV, but I'd like to be involved in particularly animation. I'd like to do... You know, I remember the old Betty Boop cartoons, and a lot of the old cartoons had some pretty hip music, and I'd like to try to explore more impressionistic, artistic things, kind of like what Ralph Bakshi was doing with some of the things he did. I'd like to be involved with somebody like that and do music that might complement that type of thing. And so animation is so expensive, you know, I'm just realizing that to do like $1,000 a minute to do a cartoon, you know, so...
How about movie soundtracks, which have had a big impact on you?
I'll tell you, one of them is, and I know everybody knows this, but Anatomy of a Murder. I mean, when you go back and listen, it's so different and it's so unusual. But if you ever get to see the movie's great itself with Jimmy Stewart, it's real long, involved plot of a murder, and Duke Ellington does some cameo appearances in it, and he does the music. He plays a character named Pie Eye in it, and it's just the music is so unusual in it because. Duke is coming from he's coming from a whole nother bent. I think most musicians in jazz that turn to scoring films like Quincy Jones or Benny Golson, they begin to I think they get into a certain bag with that and they lose some of the distinctiveness in what they're doing. In that when I hear their scores, I can't really hear their background in it, you know. But Duke's thing, you could tell it was Duke Ellington right away. I mean, it's just he didn't try to hide it or. And I just appreciated that, and it's an exceptional film score. I think it's there was another film score I saw with a movie. It was a long time ago, but the film score was by Shostakovich, and I can't even remember the name of the film, but it had a big impact on me. He did it was very dark and foreboding kind of score to it, and I can't even remember the name of the film. But some different films with composers who are well known and establish their own style, and they can maintain that style and integrate that with the film, like The French Connection. Don Ellis did the music for that, and that was, to me, that wiped me out. I mean, that was a great, to me, this is a great, great film score. I think he got an Oscar for it, too. I think he did it for that. But if you get a chance to see French Connection, he did the music for that.
I thought of, not because of any literal quote or anything like that, but just because of the kind of the somberness and the of both the beginning and the end of Honky Tonk Bud and kind of the long notes and the trombones in it. I was thinking of the score for Taxi Driver by Bernard Herrmann. Did you?
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that. That's you know, all these things I've seen and they've had an influence on me, and I'm kind of just getting my feet wet with this media. And I couldn't really say that what I did was a film score, because we really did the score and they shot the movie to what I did. But it would be more interesting if I was presented with a rough edit of a movie and I was called upon to write the music. So I hope to be in that position. There's a few opportunities kind of looking my way, and it's kind of exciting. See if I can do it.
My guest is Edward Wilkerson, and he is the director of the Shadow Vignettes, and their record, Birth of a Notion, is available on Sesame's Records, which is available in Chicago, or produced out of Chicago, rather. Shadow Vignettes now is an ensemble of 25 players. Is it tough to meet that payroll? Can you support a band of 25?
Yeah, it's tough to meet the payroll. You know, well, what happens is we don't work. We haven't been working a whole lot, and we haven't traveled a whole lot either. And what I want to do is step up that now that we have the album. I'm finding people are interested in the group, and we're finding kind of alternate means of funding and touring. So one thing is that when you take a group out, say it's a big band, 16 pieces, once you get to the size of transportation, renting a Greyhound, it doesn't matter whether you have 16 on the bus or you have 40, it's going to cost the same. So I decided that if we could find ways, if we could use the bus to get to gigs, a Greyhound, then we can fill up the space much easier, because we're you know, once you pass through a city, it doesn't make sense not to play there. That's my philosophy. So any city we go through, we're going to play through if it's a major sized city. So if we can fill up enough of those spaces like that with gigs, then it can be a worthwhile tour, and everybody can be paid fairly and make the band function. But it takes a lot of really advanced booking. You know, you have to book like 6 months, a year in advance. And it takes a lot of just preparation, and that's, I'm finding people to help out who are involved with that preparation, who are helping with promotions, and who are helping on it as an agent capacity. And I'm learning myself about all this. So in as far as meeting a payroll, I don't, you know, I pay them when we work. It's not like I got these guys every week that come for their check, because we don't work that much. But hopefully we're going to schedule at least 3 or 4 tours over the next year. And some of the tours may be a week, some of them might be 2 weeks, but we're going to try to get the band functioning, getting out of town, and I think that's an excitement of going out with a band that size that's missed. You know, I have this old friend, and he's a baritone saxophonist, and he was telling me about the time that he went out with Cootie Williams' big band. You know, they had approached him. He was like the hot baritone saxophonist in Chicago, and they said, "Yeah, we're going down south. We'll have you back home in about 2 weeks." He said he didn't get back home for about a year and a half. They got him out, and he never had enough money to get home. They went down south and out west and up the north coast and everything. But he said it was the best time of his life, you know, and he said he wouldn't have traded it for anything. And he said the friendships and the comradeship that you develop in traveling with a group that size, it's really a special type of thing. And I miss that. I've been out with some bands, you know, not that size, but there's something about going out on the road that's real special, and with this size group, we're going to try to recapture some of that and kind of express it in a new kind of way. So when we travel, it's going to be when we went up to Minneapolis, we had a nice little short tour going up there, and it worked out very well. So hopefully, we'll be able to do more of that.
Well, your record is on an independent record label, Sesame's Records, and you know there's a post office box, and actually I can give that for people to write away. It's not the type of record that you'll necessarily find in a store unless you really search for it.
Well, we're gonna change that. I'm gonna the people who are you can write to me, or you can call New Music Distribution in New York, and New Music Distribution Service, and they can get the record. And we're getting it in the stores. It's just it runs out real fast. So be patient. If you don't have it, you can write to this. You want me to give the address?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead. The Chicago
Post Office. Just write to Sesame's Records, Post Office Box 6812, Chicago, Illinois, 60680. And just say you want the record or you're interested in the video. We're selling the video, too. Or whatever, if you just want to join the fan club or whatever. I think we give away decoder rings or something with that. So if whatever you want, you know, you can contact me if you don't want to just express what you thought of the album. I'm trying to keep direct contact with people who are listening to the music and buying the record. And so that's Post Office Box 6812, Shadow Vignettes, or Sesame's Records, Chicago, Illinois, 60680.
Well, how do you get the record in the store? I mean, how do you take on an independent promotion effort? Like, for instance, you're visiting radio stations now, but it's not as if there's a large record company to bankroll your publicity here.
Yeah. Well, this is a shoestring budget we're working off of. And one thing, I tried to take advantage of the fact that airline rates are very low now. I can actually fly places cheaper than it is to drive, really. And, you know, if you fly at night or you fly on People's Express, you know, you might have to sleep in an airport or two, but you can get places pretty cheaply. And the oil rates are down. So next weekend I'm driving up to Cleveland and Detroit. And I know people in all these cities who I can stay with. So it's a shoestring budget, but I'm able to get out and meet people and kind of just understand more about the business and see how the whole mechanism fits. Because I would really like to change it, but you can't change it unless you have some kind of understanding of it. So I'd like to try to mold it a little more so it'll work for me. And I'm learning, you know, and it's helped a lot because I'm meeting people such as yourself and these types of stations that I find I'm really dependent upon to get the record played. I'm just realizing now how much you all are, WHYY and WRTI and XPN. These are the stations who are really going to play the record. And I have to maintain contact with people like you all and try to see ways that we can foster the type of relationship so that, you know, not just me, but a lot of people are coming out with records on their own or independent distribution things or things that are not necessarily produced by the big labels in New York. And I think it's a welcome change. I think you're finding more and more people in different regions who are producing things that are real strong, you know, real strong musically and strong packaging. And, you know, I see the group out, Mopro, what is it, Mopro out of Cincinnati, that label. They're producing that Blue Mist big band. What is Blue Wisp?
I don't know.
It's a real nice big band, real good music. And then the guy Gonzalez down in Texas, he's got an album out that's real good. And just different productions that are outside of New York and outside of the major labels, but they're real professional, very well done. And I think it's good because it's going to return to the old days when you had these regional bands that were real hot. You know, I mean, you go to Kansas City, man, there were cats there that burn you up, you know. You come to Chicago, you know, you got Johnny Griffin cats like that. You know, I mean, I hear tales of like when Train used to come through, man, and cats, you know, jump on him, man. I mean, he come through town and cats were bad. I mean, nobody was trying to go to New York to get acceptance. Cats were really bad where they were. In Chicago, man, they tell me, you know, Bird used to come through, but there was a cat named Henry Pryor, man. This cat was, you know, I mean, nobody was really jumping back because somebody was from New York. Like, that kind of happens now, you know, if a group's from New York, they get most of the media attention, and they're expected to be the baddest thing in town. And it's not necessarily like that. They're good bands wherever you go, you know. And I'd like to see ways that we could push these bands where in their own hometowns, kind of like what Prince has done in Minneapolis. He's decided to stay there and make Minneapolis happen, and he's producing bands there. He's got the facilities, and it's first rate material. And you can't tell us, and he's not in L.A. I mean, it's an original sound, and I think he feels if he went out to L.A., it'd become diluted. And he's got cats he's grown up with, and they've worked on that sound for years, and that's why it's so distinctive. And that's with the AECM. That was one of the reasons we've kept it, the main headquarters in Chicago, is because there's a distinctive AECM approach that it's just part of Chicago, you know, and it reflects the Chicago life. So there's a distinctive Philadelphia approach. You know, there was a time when There were schools of tenor playing, and Philadelphia was one of the main schools, you know, with Train and those cats coming out of here. Wasn't Hank Mobley from here?
Yeah, he still is.
And you had Chicago. I mean, you had Johnny Griffin and Von Freeman, and you had out in Texas, Ornette Coleman and those types of cats, man. And I mean, I could tell where a dude was from by the way he played. People don't believe this, but to this day, if a guy has been true to where he comes from, I can listen to him playing. I can tell what city. I can sometimes I can tell the street he lived on in the house. I mean, I sometimes miss the house by a block or two. But, you know, I mean, that's regional playing. And that's what I like. That's more exciting than everybody sounding like one school, like going to New York. And I don't want to sound like New York's not happening, but I think there's been a tendency to kind of funnel guys through here and kind of mold them into a certain image. And then they say, okay, you're ready, you're packaged. Now you're ready to be marketed. Boom, you sound like this, you know. And, you know, I think it's more exciting when cats can stay home and kind of, you know, make that impact all over the country and keep their flavor, their regional flavor.
Well, let's listen to another recording from the record. And what I have up is the names have been changed. And what was going on in your mind musically when you composed this?
Well, let me see. I'm trying to remember when I did write this. I wrote this thing. I wrote the melody to it, and all at once it just kind of came out like a, you know, I don't know what it. But then the whole arrangement took me quite a while. I kind of wrote it in stages. And what it was just an idea of switching back and forth from 4-4 to 7-4 time. The what they call the head of the tune is in 4-4, and the bridge is in 7-4.
Can you sing that or to try to connect?
Okay, here's the melody. It goes that's the melody, that's the head. Then the bridge goes and most people are not used to 7-4 time, but I wanted them to feel real natural with it. It's an odd meter. And then the whole epilogue part is in 7-4. So we wanted to have that little transition thing and keep the energy up, you know, like it was one of these old jungle tunes, you know, and keep the energy, that kind of energy, but in a new setting. And so we captured it good. We got a real nice mix on it. And with a group this size, that was one of the main problems. You go in the studio and we had to have a real big studio. And we, you know, it's hard to even find places to put everybody. And then trying to mix it so that it sounds real. We recorded everything at once. We didn't layer it or anything like that. And to try to keep that liveness in there. And you want cats to play hard, but you got to remember that you got strings in the room and you can't overpower them. And then you want Reggie to be able to hear the strings, and they're on the other side of the room and the trumpets are in the middle blasting. So we were real creative in how we did it, and we didn't use any headphones, and what we did was set up monitors in the corners of the studio, and we put them out of phase with the microphones, so the microphones wouldn't pick up the monitors, you know. So it was real nice the way we did it. I think we got a good mix. It sounds real acoustic. I didn't want it to sound like it was in a studio. I wanted it to sound like it was a performance and try to make it sound as real as possible. And those were some of the problems in dealing with a group this size. We went in a studio where they normally record like orchestras, and it's real big, but it worked out nice, and I learned a lot in that situation. So the names have been changed is an attempt to keep that higher energy up there. And, you know, when everybody's playing that loud, it's hard to hear, but they did a nice job.
Who'd you have in mind musically in terms of the inspiration or the influences?
I tell you, there's a piece, old piece, a couple old pieces, you know, some old Duke Ellington, some of those jungle pieces. And then there's this... there's this piece by Jimmy Lunsford. It's called Jazznocracy. It was like his theme song. It went dun 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 dun. And that's always been one of my favorite pieces. You know, it's just I like the discipline of Lunsford's band, and I like they were just hard hitting. You know, they were just like a real heavyweight band, real muscular. So I like that quality in our band too. So we do pieces that kind of show that aspect off.
Well, let's hear it from the Shadow Vignettes recording, Birth of a Notion. This is Edward Wilkerson's composition, The Names Have Been Changed.
We'll be right back.
That was The Names Have Been Changed, and that was written by my guest, Edward Wilkerson, one of the numbers on the Shadow Vignettes recording, Birth of a Notion. Let me ask you about a really different type of music context in which you play, and your jobs with Bobby Blue Bland, the blues singer, and Little Anthony in the Imperials.
Oh, yeah.
What are those gigs like?
Well, I'll tell you, the Little Anthony gigs, I did them as part of a 50s show. There's a lot of 50s shows kind of floating around town, and a few years ago, they had a 50s, and in one night I played with Little Anthony Imperials, the Shirelles, the Coasters, the Drifters. I can't remember. There was one other group. But I played with all those groups, and I tell you, I got goosebumps, you know, doing Going Out of My Head and all the Little Anthony stuff. And he is a big jazz fan. He said the most intense musical experience he had was going to hear Coltrane. And he's very knowledgeable about music. And it was a nice thing. He's a very nice person, Anthony Gordine, I think is his name. in those types of gigs, I couldn't say I was really, you know, these are like kind of recollection shows, and they're not really, you know, I couldn't say it's the type of thing where you're really playing with the group when the music is fresh and kind of happening. It's really, they do them just like they did on the record, and everybody realizes it's not, you know, it's not the kind of thing where everything is as fresh as with, say, somebody like Bobby Bland, or I work with Albert King. And with those groups, the music is a lot. There's an attempt to make it fresh each night, and there's new lines, and things change on stage, and it's not such a set format. And I enjoy those gigs for that aspect of it, because I learned a lot on how to deal with an audience from these guys, because they know how to take hecklers and kind of turn them on their side, and they know how to charm women, and they know how to really handle an audience and take them through a lot of different emotional changes. And I did some work with Albert King. We toured a little bit, and that was fun. We went through Ohio, and I've worked with Gene Chandler a lot, and you know, the Duke of Earl. Now that'll give you goosebumps when you hear him do that. And we went all down south and everything, and it's a nice experience. I think every musician should do that on occasions, and I still will if I have the opportunities, go out and play with in some different musical settings like that.
Are those gigs challenging musically? I mean, do you have to be a good sight reader? Do you have to like cop a certain type of style?
Yeah, you do have to sight read very well. Most of the gigs, the music is written out, because some of these bands change personnel, you know, quite a bit. Like Bobby Bland, though, keeps the same band for quite a while, but some bands will change up, or they'll take horn players on in each city. But I tell you, as far as soloing, it's very demanding. I mean, you have to really know the styles that they're expecting to hear in order to solo on that stuff, and you have to know your history. And it's demanding. I mean, you can't play around in these settings, because the music has such a strong tradition, and there's a strong audience band interaction. And I like to try to, the challenge for me is to try to integrate my style into what they're expecting, and still kind of lead them on into something a little different from what they're expecting. And that's always fun, you know, and that's, you have to have a certain control over that style. But then you take them into, you know, and you let them hear a little bit of what you might do on your set. And so even though you can't completely go into it, you can kind of give them a little taste for it. And then maybe later on, if they hear you perform, they'll say, oh yeah, I can see what he's doing, because I've heard it in another, come out of another context. So you play like a history of the saxophone in one solo.
Well, how would you describe maybe the style expected for playing on, you know, Duke of Earl or mm-hmm. Tears on My Pillow?
Oh. Or, you know. Yeah, well, it's a very kind of melodramatic style. There's a couple of guys who kind of have influenced, I feel, the popular saxophone. And excuse me, one was Louis Jordan. I mean, to be able to take a jazz style and popularize it was a very difficult thing. Him, say, Leo Parker, and then in the modern guys, you got like King Curtis, and I can't remember his name now.
Junior Walker,
yeah. And these guys have taken the kind of a jazz vocabulary. And in the 40s and 50s, they popularized it. Leo Parker was another baritone saxophonist. And to see that evolution, there's a nice album out of anybody. It's called Honkers and Screamers. But it's a lot of early rock and roll saxophonists like Paul Humphreys and, Paul Hucklebutt Williams and some of these guys who were really, they were excellent jazz players, but they were taking this vocabulary and popularizing it in another way. Count Basie was involved with that too. And it's a very exciting period to me. And to understand how that was done, that's what you have to know in order to play with these bands. You have to know that little 20 or 30 year history. And so in what I do, I kind of use that and then move into some inflections that, you know, that I learned from, like, Henry Threadgill is an expert at, like, taking those types of inflections and moving it off into another setting, or somebody like Oliver Lake. I mean, you can hear the direct evolution through that period. So I could easily hear Threadgill play with any of these bands, you know. And I've heard him in different settings play. We went out to a jam session one time with Von Freeman, and everybody was doing ballads and stuff, you know. And he said, well, what you going to do, Threadgill? He said, let me play Come Sunday. You know, I mean, nobody's going to Come Sunday at a club, you know. But he did it, man. He just wiped everybody out, you know, because he's got that real, it's so dramatic and, you know, all the high notes and everything. And he just killed the audience, but he was playing his way, you know. But he knows how to lead people into it and have, he just has that sound that just draws people to him. And that's something that, you know, some of the great ones have.
Do you have to learn dance steps for the band?
Yeah, we did some stepping with Gene Chandler, and I'm still learning some steps. I'll tell you who's a great. That was a tradition of dancing and playing at the same time, and Von Freeman is one of the experts at that. And you have to. It's one of the hardest things to do in the world. I've always wanted him to teach me how to dance and play at the same time, but he's one of the people who can do it. And it was a tradition back in the 40s and 50s to be able to do that, and it's kind of a lost art. But with the steps we did were a lot easier. It wasn't really dancing. It was like stepping. But to be able to dance and play is if you've ever played in a marching band, you know the difficulty in just walking and playing. And you don't mind doing some dancing. So it's pretty rough. So, yeah, we did a little bit of stepping, but not extensive like some of the groups because what they do is it really tears up your horn because every time you make them hit a microphone stand or something, you lose a key. So I didn't really want to do too much stepping there.
How about how you get dressed? Do you have to run in tux frequently for these gigs or wear the same type of suit that the other horn players are?
Yeah, tux type of deal. I just keep a couple of tuxes at home on standby for those types of things.
How's the quality of the gig for that type of circuit? Like you were talking about the 50th circuit. I mean, is the band treated well? Is the pay good? How are the clubs?
The band is treated all right. It depends on the band leader. And I'll tell you, some of the band leaders I played with are really rotten. And, I mean, these were pretty famous guys, too. But then some of them, like Little Anthony, was very considerate. And it varies. It varies on the situation. The clubs vary. It's some nice experiences. Some of them are a little on the unpleasant side, but most of them are really nice.
What are the unpleasant memories that you have?
Well, I've seen situations where, like, guns were pulled on people.
Really? Why?
Well, then we had some altercations in the bus, and a gun was pulled on one guy. And I hear this particular band leader would do that all the time, you know, the threatened guys. And one time the gun went off. But that kind of thing, I don't think it goes on as much as it used to. I've been in, I've been on shows with some of these groups where, you know, you'd be out front and there's a whole bunch of groups are going to perform on a certain show. And you think everything's cool, but backstage, one group, there was a promoter. One group grabbed the promoter, took him into this room, and they hadn't gotten their front money, and they actually threatened this guy to get their front money. So they went on, they had gotten their front money, and went on. Then the next group had to do the same thing. Each of these groups has a bodyguard, so they kind of threatened the promoter, got their money. And it was just, I just saw that there was, groups were skipping out on hotel bills and things like that, and these were very well-known groups, and I it's a shame that situation has to endure like that, because It's the fault. It's everybody's fault. It's no one particular person's fault, but it's a situation that sometimes it can really be very, very disheartening for somebody like me, because I'm there just kind of checking things out, and I just want to be on the gig to say that I've played with these guys, and it's really an honor to be on the gig with a lot of these people, and to see them treated in this way, and to have their money held up for different reasons. I can see why some of them were bitter and they were kind of surly about it, you know, and I can understand. You go through that for 30 or 40 years of, you know, you perform and not get your money, or you drive 1,000 miles, you know, in a day to do a gig and the gig gets canceled. You know, that's, you know, one thing like Albert King, he drives his own bus, you know. I met him, I worked with him. He picked me up in Chicago. They had just finished playing in Chicago. It was like 3 a.m, hopped on the bus. He drove all the way to Dayton, you know, without any sleep. And that's what kind of guy he is. He's one of those iron guys, you know. And he's the last of a certain breed of guy who's like that. Since it's his own bus, he books his own tours, he schedules all this stuff, he drives the bus, he's an excellent guitar player. He's really underrated as a guitar player and does the shows. And this guy is just, he's just phenomenal.
Do you find that after having done a set of gigs with either, you know, with Anthony or your Bobby Blue Bland or some other, you know, either soul or pop type thing, does that cross-fertilize with your other playing?
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. And I want that to happen. I think that's why I do those things. It's not really for the money, because it's not really a lot of money, but I do it for the experience, and I want that to be in my playing. I want those types of environments and those types of situations to be in my playing, because I want to make sure that I have that thread of continuity going through what I'm doing. And I want to be able to get in those situations and be able to, you know, get in, create that type of sound that's needed for it. And it's a good challenge, and I want to be, you know, up to that kind of challenge.
Well, thanks a lot for being here today, and good luck with the record.
Okay, thank you for having me.